This is The Blueprint with Chris Phillips on Jazz FM. Listening colour.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the canteen. Tonight we are very fortunate to present the truly great trumpeter, Chet Baker, alongside Jerry Mulligan. He became the leading exponent of that cool, fragile sound known as West Coast Jazz. Tonight and for the rest of the week, he's here with John Haller and the trio. Ladies and gentlemen, Chet Baker.
Chet Baker and Have You Met Miss Jones, recorded live in London with the John Haller Trio, a British rhythm section. And it was at a venue called The Canteen in Covent Garden, and it forms part of a superb double CD which is out now, Chet Baker Live in London. But the circumstances behind this release and how these sessions came to light is as brilliant as the music itself. I was fortunate enough to get time with bassist Jim Richardson, who played in the band. And just an advance warning, this interview contains one factual profanity, so if you are easily offended, please dip the volume or turn it off right now. There we are. So here's Martin Hummel, who's releasing this on his label Ubuntu Music.
Chris, it's actually a wonderful story, and I have, first and foremost, Jim Richardson to thank for that. It was a late night at Ronnie Scott's. In October a year ago, I was checking some of my friends who were playing that evening. Jim was there. I was introduced to Jim, and he told me a story that I just could not get out of my head, which is basically, back in 1983 at the Canteen, March 28th to April 2nd, Jim Richardson, John Horler on piano, and Tony Mann on drums played with Chet Baker for six evenings. And at that show, or series of shows, Jim had asked Chet if he could actually record the music for his own purposes, which Chet certainly allowed him to do. Jim had the music. The music was actually exceptional relative to Chet's playing, along with the rhythm section. And Jim very much wanted that music to be heard by the world at large. The problem or issue was actually severalfold. How do you get an okay from the Chet Baker estate in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who are a little nervous about those things and feel as though the world is out to rip them off? And secondly, what do you do with music that's been sitting in a shoebox, essentially, for 33 years, where the audio cassette tape dissipates over time? And it was Jim's desire and ambition to see this music brought to the world at large, which created the challenge and also the opportunity.
Set the scene for us, Jim. Tell me the story leading up to you guys playing with Chet Baker in London all those years ago.
Well, just to dwell on Chet for 2 seconds, he was firing on all cylinders, physical difficulty or not. He was certainly up there in his mind and his heart. Yeah, he's great. I first heard Chet Baker with the Jerry Mulligan Quartet when I was a 14-year-old schoolboy.
Yeah.
I did two albums with Chet in 1979, along with Tony Mann. And I'd just come back from the States. I'd been out there, and I thought I was coming back to a work famine, and the phone rang, and I've just staggered in from the airport with my bass, my electric bass, my case and everything, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be skint now for I don't know how long. And the phone rang half an hour after me walking through the door, and I got two recording dates with Chet Baker in Knightsbridge for 750 quid, and that was pretty handy. But anyway, jump forward to 83. I got a call, I can't remember from who, asking me and Tony Mann to work with Chet because he'd actually expressly asked for us, which is a real good pat on the back. You know, it kills you, that kind of thing. And I straight away, you know, we needed a trio leader, and I straight away thought of John Haller, who I'd known from, I've known him since 1969. Lovely man, beautiful musician. And off we went. It was fantastic. It was like, we were nervous, of course, you know, he's sitting and, you know, there on the stage and right next to the man, and you're going to be nervous about this because he's such a giant. And I thought after a couple of days, this is really, I've got to bring the Walkman in. And I had a TCS 300 Sony Walkman, and I brought it in, and I'm standing at the bar with Chet after the first set. And I held the Walkman in front of him. I said, Chet, would this bother you? Would you mind about this? And he looked at me and he looked at the machine, and his exact words, just three words, were, what? Fuck you! And hugged me, gave me a bear hug, like, get on with it, man. What are you asking for? Because it wasn't meant for commercial release. Not at all. It was for me. I've got loads of archive stuff, and I'd never do anything illegal against musical colleagues, whether I know them or not. You don't do that. There's enough cookery in this business anyway. And that was it. And it's no idea of it being commercially released. Then I thought, well, hang on. And musicians were saying, this should be out there. The world needs this, you know, it's because it's fabulous. And Martin is a dream of a geezer, a pot of gold at the end of a rainbow, an absolute honest businessman, and we're in cahoots. It's taken a lot of work and a lot of money, and it's come up good. It's come up far better than I thought it would have. Thank you.
Chet Baker live in London, a new double CD for Ubuntu Music, and that is for minors only. Live sessions at the Canteen in Covent Garden. You're listening to The Blueprint, and I'm Chris Phillips. More now from my conversation with the bassist on this session, Jim Richardson, and producer Martin Hummel. You were presented with these tapes that had just been, I guess, sitting in a box for 33 plus years, yeah. Something like that. They must have been degraded. There must have been a ton of tapes in there. Yeah, and the sound you've managed to get from these cassette tapes is absolutely astounding. You'd never know it wasn't recorded in a proper professional live unit. I mean, tell me about the process of bringing the music back to life.
Certainly. Jim and I went through a number of hurdles to get it to where it is right now. And it was an extraordinary experience, a learning experience, I think, for all of us, including those who are involved with it. What happens with audio cassette tape over time is essentially two things. It stretches with age, ever so slightly, and also the magnetic particles, which basically comprise the sound on the tape itself, begin to dissipate and fall off. So you've got some problems. And then you compound that by the fact that Jim had his Sony Walkman cassette recorder sitting on his bass cabinet, which can create certain interferences when it comes to audio quality. We had a few hurdles to overcome, but Jim, with his contacts and connections and a few people I knew, we did a series of experiments. I had to first convert it from an audio cassette format into a digital format of some sort, because I couldn't listen to them. I didn't have an audio cassette player. And it was a crude first step, but even as crude as that sound was in the first phase, you could see immediately there was great playing there. And that was, to me, the big, big yes that came out of this. The playing was so exceptional that we would do anything to get it right. From there, we found a great engineer in the name of Claudio Passavante, yeah, at Sunlight Square. Really great guy. We love him with a passion, and he tolerated us by sitting on him morning, noon, and night, too many days of the week, to actually do a proper, if you will, conversion from audio cassette to digital format. And then once you had it in a digital format, you needed to clean up the pops, the hisses, the idiosyncrasies that, again, with age and crude recording, you'll face. But I think the most important part in all of this was we wanted to preserve the integrity of the music itself. It would have been very, very easy to take this stuff and to essentially lay on heavy reverb and have it sound like it was recorded in a symphony hall. That wasn't the magic. The magic was the Canteen, 70, 80 people, maximum capacity, listening in an intimate environment of a master who is probably one of the greatest jazz trumpeters in the history of the music.
As Martin said, it sort of jumped all sort of hoops. It took 5 mastering sessions.
Yeah.
And the bass cabinet that machine was sitting on, the machine was 4 inches away from a 12-inch speaker with a 5-inch magnetic cone. It shouldn't have happened. This is so fortuitous. And then you got the problem of the separation of the rhythm section from Chet playing and singing right on top of the mic, and us being where we were. You know, drums suffer a little from that because they're a little further away than piano and bass.
Touch of your lips upon my face, your lips that are cool and sweet, such tenderness lies in their soft caress. Of your hand upon my brow, the love in your eyes is shining. moment divine. The touch of your lips on mine.
With the touch of your lips, A new CD out now, Chet Baker Live in London. This is The Blueprint, and more now from my conversation with the band's bassist, Jim Richardson, whose personal takes brought this to life. And I asked him about Chet Baker, the person. He'd had his problems, his drug addictions, they were well documented. So what was he like at the time?
In terms of psychodrama, there wasn't really any to talk of. He was just nice, really nice, as he was in 1979. Whatever kind of history he's got, whoever he upset, wherever and whenever, didn't catch one jot of that. He was a nice fella. Back to what I said about giving me the bear hug, like, get on with it. You want to record this stuff? Knock yourself out.
And have you seen the film portraying Chet's life called Born to be Blue?
Martin and me went to Ronnie Scott's a few weeks ago. The Canadian director, he was there, and we saw the film. He did a Q&A afterwards, after he spoke about his own film. And there's a Canadian book about Chet, which is terribly negative. That author, I can really, you know, I'd like to, well...
meet him.
Yeah. No, forget all that. I don't want to be too negative. But Robert Bordeaux, he came up with this great film, which dwelt too much, really, on the life of the man and not enough music. And didn't touch about Jerry Mulligan.
Exactly.
That gave me the ump. Jerry Mulligan, after all, was Chet Baker's springboard.
With Chet, in 1983, you played at a place called The Canteen down
That's
in Covent
right.
Garden. It's not there anymore, is it?
No.
Yeah, it was probably a soap shop or something.
No, it used to be called The Blitz, then it was The Canteen, then it was a gentleman's club, like a mini Spearmint Rhino. More than that, I don't know. The Canteen, I did a few gigs there. I worked there with Art Farmer as well. Did a load of gigs with Mose Allison. Load of gigs. I've got loads of tapes of that. It's fantastic to work with. Funny man. You've got the intimacy on those recordings, which we did work. Martin, myself, and dear Claudio Passavanti, we worked hard at preserving that intimacy. And Claudio, bless him, has really come up with the goods on that. Yeah.
You must be incredibly proud of this project, Jim.
Well, I'm just a bass player who happened to turn up with a tape recorder when it all comes down. The great, great man is Chet Baker. I'm so very, very happy. I'm an archivist, and I went in, and I've got tapes at home of Mose Allison, Lockjaw Davis, Art Farmer, loads of Bill Watrous, a great trombone player, loads of people, and Barney Kessel, tons of tapes, because I toured with Barney for 10 years.
Listen, what an amazing story, and thank you so much, Jim, for preserving these tapes in a box and allowing Martin to, you know, buff them up and put them out there for all of us to consume and enjoy. And I know you've brought the project back to life as well with the original John Haller Trio.
Yeah.
A couple of nights packed out at Ronnie Scott's. I mean, that was an instant sellout. I mean, that must have felt good.
And the product we sold, I don't think anyone else has sold that much product in the foyer at Ronnie Scott's. And very, very well received, encores both nights and all that. It was wonderful. It couldn't be more, well, I don't know about perfect. There's no such thing as perfection. You get holes in your hands and feet if you start getting too perfect. But it's like, no, it was a gas. It really was. I'm a very happy bunny.
Jim and Martin from Ubuntu Music, thanks for coming in.